Pitch Black Reel 2.
The driving and maintenance took the place of equitation. Signal training became largely wireless training rather than the old-fashioned, more primitive forms of signaling. And gunnery became entirely machine gunnery instead of mostly musketry, and was very soon followed, of course, by tank gunnery proper with real guns as opposed to machine guns. And when we first mechanized, the only tanks we had were light tanks, which were only equipped with a 303 machine gun and a 0.5 machine gun, and then only in theory, because neither of these weapons was ever actually present in the vehicle.
When did the mechanization take place?
It was announced on the 1st of January 1938, and the commanding officer came round the regiment and announced it in all the mess halls to the soldiers who were going to be mechanized. And he said, they've given us 2 years to do it in, but I have told them that we will go to camp mechanized on the 1st of January 1939. And there was a great sort of gasp, followed by a cheer from the soldiers. And we did it, in fact, with the time to spare.
What was the reaction of you and your fellow officers when you heard that you were going to be mechanized?
Oh, well, we were all relieved that it had finally come, because I always remember when I first joined the regiment in Secunderabad in 1933, one of the first questions I remember asking my then squadron leader was, what about mechanization? And I remember him saying to me, well, the 11th and 12th have been mechanized for years, and it's a great pity that we all weren't mechanized years ago. And though there were, I think there was only one officer who was then the second in command who left because he didn't feel he could face mechanization, but he was due to leave shortly anyway, and he went off to Kenya and retired there. But our commanding officer happened to be an extremely mechanically minded man. He'd actually had his own amateur radio station when the regiment was in England, and he was knowledgeable about motor cars and gadgets and all sorts, and was a gunnery expert and became later commandant of the machine gun school. And so with him at the head, the mechanization, you know, didn't meet with any resistance. And he made the very good move when we sent off people on the special courses. He made the very good move of sending the horsiest people on the courses straight away, instead of sort of keeping the sergeant major riding instructor hanging on with the tail end of what riding there was, which was very little. He sent those people straight off on courses right at the very start, and it was immediately shown that being a very good horseman was no handicap to being very good at driving and maintenance or whatever else it was. The horses all went, actually. We weren't left with any at all except our own private animals.
And can you tell me about what happened when your first equipment arrived?
Well, it's rather a classic story, because the first thing to arrive was a rather ancient Ford motor car. And the regimental quartermaster sergeant, there's a man called Stone Street, commonly known as Kipper Feet because of the angle of his feet, who was a splendid, dignified senior warrant officer, went down to the station to take it over. And it arrived, of course, without any petrol in it. And secondly, he couldn't drive. He had never learned, as far as I know. So it was pushed from the station by some Indian saises, with Stone Street sitting dignifiedly at the wheel, driving into the barracks at 1 mile an hour.
And what about when you got your first tanks? What was it, a good standard of equipment?
Well, they were very, I can't remember exactly the mark, Mark 1, Mark 2, the earliest light tanks. They had only two people, a driver and a commander. And the commander was supposed to con the tank, operate the wireless set, if it had had a wireless set in it, which it didn't generally, fire the machine gun, which is a two-man job anyway, to fire a Vickers machine gun, and give instructions to the driver of the tank. There were no proper internal communication apparatus, headphones and so on. You can't really have a speaking tube in a tank because the turret goes round and the tube gets tangled up. So really communication was largely done by kicking the chap in the back to go on and pulling his hair to make him stop.
What about if you wanted him to turn right or to turn left?
You kicked him on the right side, you kicked him on the left side. It was very primitive. And we had little coloured flags, about half, 7 or 8 of them, which were meant to mean different things. And I remember my troop sergeant had a very recalcitrant tank, which was always breaking down. They were all given names of hunts in a typical cavalry fashion. And this horrible vehicle was called Chiddingfold, as far as I remember. And my troop sergeant broke down miles from anywhere in the middle of a manoeuvre, and we found him eventually sitting there forlornly, and he'd put all the flags, they sort of joined together, and he had a sort of mast of 8 signal flags stuck up on the top of his tank in the hopes that somebody would see it and come and rescue him.
You've written in the regimental history that you wrote that the cavalry was very vulnerable to air attack. Did you have any joint training exercises with the RAF in India?
Well, yes, we did. There was an RAF squadron at Delhi, and the RAF commander was a very great friend of the regiment, a chap called, subsequently an Air Vice Marshal, Laurie Sinclair, and he was then on the headquarters staff in Delhi, I think. And the RAF were used to appear on manoeuvres with the few aeroplanes they had. And in fact, the first time I ever went up in an aeroplane was Secunderabad. When they arrived, they came with a, I suppose it was something like a Hawker Hart or one of those biplane, early biplane sort of fighter bomber types. And they gave us all flights for 5 minutes each. And that's the first time I ever went up in an aeroplane.
But were there coordinated exercises between the cavalry and the...
While we were at Meerut, there was a very big brigade, I think it was an army exercise, and I know we had to cross the Jumna, and there was a great deal of hiding from the airplanes and so on. Not very easy in India, because there's not an awful lot of cover. There are no sort of thick forests or woods, and you can't hide a cavalry regiment. You can't hide a cavalry brigade of 2,000 horses in fairly open country. But we did, there were these big exercises in which the RAF did take part.
How much cooperation with the Indian Army was there?
Oh, very close, because we were part of the army in India, and our brigade, the cavalry brigade, always consisted of 1 British cavalry regiment and 2 Indian cavalry regiments. In Secunderabad we had, we had 2 different regiments in Secunderabad and another 2 in Meerut, but we were always very close with them, and on all the manoeuvres, not only the Indian cavalry, but also the private armies of the Maharajas, like the Hyderabad State Cavalry, used to take part in the manoeuvres as well. And the army was very closely integrated with the Indian Army in that way.
What were the Hyderabad State Cavalry like?
Well, we really only saw them, the Halisikar Lancers, they were called.
The what?
Halisikar Lancers. We used to play polo against their officers, and they used to appear on manoeuvres. They were slightly scattier than we were, I think, but they looked very smart, and they rode well, and they were well mounted. There was no sort of Fred Karno's army. They were very, very smart, business-like looking lot.
What precisely do you mean by scattier?
They were scattier. I don't know what scattier means. Less well controlled, shall we say. No, I mean, the manoeuvres always used to end with some cavalry charge or something like that, and it was well to be out of the way when the Halisikar Lancers started to charge.
And was your contact with the Indian Army limited to joint training and sporting activities? I mean, did you mix with Indian soldiers socially?
If Indian soldiers, you mean Indian other ranks?
Indian,
Indian
were
there
viceroys of King's commissioned officers at the
there were, and they of course were the same as one would treat them the same as Indian officers. There weren't very many of them there. They were only just beginning to appear on the scene then. There were some at Sorga on the equitation course. Otherwise, if we dined in their messes or they dined in ours and so on, we played polo together, things like that. But that's about all the meeting we had. We didn't meet Indians. We met Indian civilians very little because there were very little points of contact. The only ones I met were playing tennis. Both in Hyderabad, the Nizam's financial advisor was very keen on tennis, and he used to have very nice tennis parties with, and he had some Indian players who'd been in the Indian Davis Cup team who used to play there. And in Meerut, the resident was very keen on tennis and also had a very good grass court. And I used to play there, and there were occasionally Indians playing there. But one didn't, except for the sort of polo playing Maharajas and people one met like that, we had very little contact with Indian civilian, other than what you might call employees, shikaris, grooms, servants, and so on.
Did you ever go into the house of an Indian for a meal or anything of that kind?
Only a Maharaja. I think we used to meet them, entertained. You see, even if you stayed in a native state, you didn't stay in the Maharaja's house. You were always put up in the guest house. And you might be entertained to a party, a dinner party or a lunch party, or go and watch dancing girls in the evening or something. But one hardly ever stayed in those days in an Indian's house. And the women were still very much in purdah, and they would disappear, and say your wife, if you had one, would be taken to the back quarters to see the lady of the house. But we had practically no contact with Indian civilians anyway.
Can you tell me what the role of the cavalry in India was supposed to be?
Well, I suppose apart from sort of general strategic reasons, internal security. There's the presence of the armed force, I suppose, and to keep the relics of the mutiny, to keep the native forces stable, I suppose, and also to help with the training of the Indian Army, which we did considerably. There was a good deal of exchange of instructors and so on. Internal security, for which we were never used, actually. I don't think we ever actually took part in a riot, not in the 6 years I was there.
Were there ever any riot scares?
Well, the big riot which had occurred a few years before was Amritsar, and everyone, when General Dyer made a bloomer, and there was a terrible massacre in the square at Amritsar, and everybody had that very much on their mind and was very worried that such a thing might happen again. We were trained in internal security duties, but nothing like to the extent that the army nowadays, which spends 9/10 of its time on internal security duties and has far worse problems to deal with than we ever dreamt of in those days.
What type of training, what did the training consist of?
Well, mainly lectures on how to read the riot act and give three blasts on a bugle, and then getting the Indian magistrate to step forward and sign the paper and say that you were going to open fire and so on. All the standard security drill.
Were you ever put on standby for riot duty?
Oh yes. Occasionally there was an alarm, a mild alarm that there was some trouble in the bazaar, and we had to put on our best clothes and get our revolvers out of the armoury. You better get Sir John Marling to tell you that story. He's got a very funny story about that.
Where were these riots that were taking
place? It would always generally be in the native quarter. You see, if the cantonment was always separate, and although it had its sort of few, there were a few the natives living in the cantonment, the main part of the town or city, wherever you were, would have the kind of western part of it with the shops and so on. And then there'd be an absolutely sort of totally native bizarre quarter where Europeans really very seldom went. Certainly only under sort of, well, if you wanted something which couldn't be bought anywhere else, you would go with your driver or something there. But one trod a bit delicately about going into very bad parts of any city. It would be unwise, even in those days. There were troublemakers. It varied very much in different times. I remember once I was driving through Delhi in my car, and a man on a bicycle without any brakes came down a hill out of a side turning and actually ran into me. I didn't run into him, and he ran into me broadside and went, what my dear old neighbour here describes as bustle over hairpins, into the road. And he wasn't really hurt. But immediately, a large crowd started to gather, and a troublemaker shot out of nowhere and sort of shouted, "You know, you caused the accident. This poor man is hurt. You know, now get the police." And my driver said, "Go on quick and get on out of it." And we got on out of it.
Did you hear anything more of it?
No, the man wasn't hurt. It was his fault anyway. And there were obviously places in varied in different cities where it would be unwise for people to go. But it was India at that time was very quiet, and there was very little trouble.
Did you ever feel uneasy in any parts of towns that you went round, or at any time in India?
No, not really. Except for little incidents like the one I've just mentioned. One rather tended to keep out of, you know, uneasy parts of the town.
What was the general demeanour of the population as you went about? Did they ignore you, or did they show any particular attitude?
No, on the whole, you know, perfectly normal, friendly, like any strange town. I mean, if you speak a bit of the language and you can talk to people and ask them away, or go in the shops and buy things, they were very friendly and nothing unusual at all.
Did the cavalry have a frontier role? Were you trained for a frontier role in India?
Well, the specialists in the frontier, I think, were the guides' cavalry. That was an Indian cavalry regiment. The British cavalry, the frontier is not very suitable for cavalry operations. It's too rocky. And the British cavalry was not stationed very near the frontier. It was only behind the frontier, I suppose, in case of, you know, sort of Kipling-like invasion by the Russians.
Did you think that the Russians might invade India whilst you were there?
No, there was never any sort of thought of that at all.
So you weren't conscious of any such role? Did you have any lectures of such a kind?
No. No, nothing, I don't think really at all. I don't know.
Was the northeast frontier considered vulnerable whilst you were a soldier in India?
When you say the northeast frontier, you mean the frontier with...
through which the Japanese actually tried to enter India?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I don't think we ever thought of it as a frontier at all. The Japanese were so remote as... I don't think we thought about them. I don't remember ever thinking about the Japanese.
Can you tell me what the layout of the cantonments were like at places like Trimalgary?
Well, Trimalgary was fairly modern in that the buildings were built of granite stone, whereas in Meerut the buildings were much older and were sort of plaster and stucco, and in some places there would even be sort of thatched buildings, but Trimalgary was built of great solid granite. The barrack blocks were immense distance apart, at least 100 yards between each barrack box. So the barracks were well over a mile long. And then the officers' quarters consisted of large bungalows with large gardens and stables. And the mess was in them sort of centrally placed among these bungalows. And there'd be two or three, one unmarried officer in a bungalow, or two or three unmarried officers, three or four, depending on the size of the building. And then the stables, and then there'd be perhaps a couple of playgrounds, grounds, football grounds, hockey grounds, tennis courts. In Secunderabad, you've only got to level the ground and clear the weeds off, and you've got a tennis court. The ground is like a hard court. You can play tennis on it anyway. So there were tennis courts in every bungalow. And sergeant's mess, corporal's mess, hockey grounds the same, football, cricket grounds. Not much in the way of swimming baths, very small swimming baths for the soldiers. It was only a little sort of dank tank. But the officers used to swim in the officers' club. It had a good swimming bath.
How did you get about on such a huge area?
Oh, we all had pony traps in Secunderabad. In those days, we were still in the relics of the great polo playing dynasty in the regiment, which said that an officer shouldn't have a car, he should have two more polo ponies instead. And very few people actually had cars when I joined the regiment. Only rarely the ones who weren't keen on polo but were very keen on shooting and used to go off shooting panthers and so on. And they had cars, but we all functioned with pony traps with a sort of dog cart and a troop horse out of the lines, and took any troop in your horse in your troop, which was unrideable, had such a bad mouth that it pulled like a train, you put it in a cart. And we used to go down to barracks in this, and you had a chap sitting on the back who looked after the pony, took it away, brought it back again if need be, or just sat there waiting till you were finished. Great advantage of ponies had been like a car, it always goes the same way. So if one would set off to go somewhere and not think where you were going, the pony trap would normally have you find yourself driving into the stables, which is where I'd spend most of the time going. We used to go to polo and pony traps and go down and play tennis and go down to sailing and so on. The sailing was a bit far on the tarmac road. We used to have a taxi for that.
How could you sail in an inland place?
It was a country bed. It's got a very large lake, which is, I suppose, artificial water supply. It's about, it must be 4 or 5 square miles of lake. And the railway workshops had built a class of Breitling Sea One designs, about half a dozen of these excellent boats, because they're very flexible. You could sail them single-handed, or you could take a party of 4 or 5 people in them quite comfortably. And Thursday was a whole holiday in India, in those days, with the British Army anyway. And so we used always to sail on Thursdays and Sundays as well. It was a rather nice little sailing club, and there were races and, well, one or two boats you could just go out and sail for fun, but mostly we used to go down and race very seriously. We used to draw for boats and then you'd have a couple of races in the day.
Was the sailing club just for officers, or were civilians in it as well?
Well, yes, there were civilians from the railways and the Nizam's administration, the police and so on.
Can you tell me a little bit about mess life in the various stations in India? Did you always eat in mess?
Well, it's the unmarried officers ate in mess. The married officers ate in their own houses. They had their own cooks and servants and ate and attended their own houses, except that once a week we had a guest night, and then everybody was supposed to dine in for that, married officers and all, unless they could plead some good excuse. There wasn't a lot of mess life as such, because we all had these very comfortable bungalows with large gardens, which we took a great pride in, because servants, you see, were rarely to a penny. And very on our pay, we could well afford. The average officer would have a bear and a boy to run messages, and then you'd share a sweeper for the bungalow who did the sweeping and cleaning out the lavatories and that sort of thing. And then you'd have one or two gardeners, depending on the size of your garden, and then the stable staff. And we all had... Skanderbad was a wretched place for gardening, because it's a heavy granite sand, and nothing really grows in it except cannas. And you couldn't really grow a decent lawn in Skanderbad, because it was too hot. Proper lawn grass didn't grow. And so Skanderbad, the gardens tended to be largely consisted of pots, which I hate, dotted around in symmetrical designs. But shrubs grew well, things like bougainvillea and so on. But in Meerut, you could grow a really good grass lawn, and you could have a grass tennis court in Meerut, and a good standard grass court. And you could also grow much better variety of flowers, like delphiniums and larkspurs and carnations, and things would grow there, and the gardens were very pretty there. And the mess life, well, the unmarried officers, we'd breakfast in mess and lunch in mess and dine in mess. Dinner nights, every night except Thursday and Saturday and Sunday, which was supper nights, and you didn't have to put on mess kit for those. At dinner night, you had to go in, you know, it was prompt at 8 or whenever it was, but on supper nights, you went in when you liked and came out when you liked. We didn't spend a lot of time in the mess. We used to go in for our meals, and we rather used to go back to our bungalows and entertain there. There wasn't a lot of what you might call corporate mess life.